I'll go ahead and start by hawking the wonderful North Coast Brewing Company and their barrel-aged Old Rasputin Stout, which is fantastic. It takes the original Old Rasputin Stout and barrel ages it, as you might have inferred. And it's fantastic.
Is this in pre-used barrel, so you get like a bit of the whiskey flavor to it? Or is that
I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I definitely got a bit of the flavor to it, shall we say. It was really nice, and I love the motto on the bottle, which is "Never Say Die," and I thought that was incredibly appropriate for Old Rasputin.
Rasputin, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Although in his case, it was probably more of a "Why won't you die?"
Yeah, you know, or never say no to, like, you know, multiple relations with the Tsarist.
There's title bait right there. Last time we talked about peak Marvel and Doctor Strange, and I wasn't terribly impressed, but Sam and I went to see Thor 3, and it was absolutely fantastic. So not peak Marvel then, it would seem. It seems like they've still got some tricks up their sleeve.
I have not seen Thor 3. I heard that it's a bit of a, from what I understood, it's a bit of a departure from the other Thor movies in terms of tonality. Like, it seems like they're all going towards Guardians of the Galaxy style shenanigans.
That's fair. It kind of maintains the same kind of family dynamic from Thor 1, which I like. But yeah, it is very much that they've kind of decided to double down on the goofy Thor. And, you know, I think that's kind of a sign of strength on Marvel's heart. That, one, they're happy to see what works and double down on that, rather than, you know, insisting, these are serious movies, they must be done according to a rigid iron plan. Which doesn't at all sound like DC, does it? And I think it's to the good that they are comfortable making movies that have very different tonalities. I mean, so, you know, you can think of, like, The Winter Soldier as a very serious, glum movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I say that, you know, it's probably one of my favorite Marvel movies, but it's a very serious movie. And then you have this, which is just a big old ball of goofy delight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have almost no criticisms to advance of it. But yes, it was a lot of fun. I liked it a lot. I do have a more traditional piece of follow-up that I wanted to bring up, which was when I was editing the last episode. In the discussion or in the robot sex portion of the show, someone on your end, Mike, raised a question in the background about, well, what about the disabled? And I wondered if either of you had any follow up on that.
Well, I don't know that there would be much of a market for robot sex with people who are significantly disabled. I mean, to my understanding, part of the draw of the existing sex surrogates practice that has become a very small industry is that not only is there, I mean, the sexual release available to those who have significant disabilities, but it's also a matter of human companionship and touch in general, because often, you know, people treat people who have, you know, amputated limbs or whatever else it is as if they're sort of made of glass and they can't touch them. And so there's too many other things going on there for me to think that just having a sort of mechanical replacement for sex via a robot would do it. I think the need is bigger there, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I could see, though, like, robot sex being covered by insurance for the disabled. I could see this being considered as a neat solution to this problem. Oh, you know, we'll just cover the robot sex.
You had put in something in the show notes, Sam, and I apologize, I haven't read it yet, asking whether sex is a need in the first place. Is there anything from that article that intersects here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the way the author of that article was talking about sex, it's not a need. It's more like a drive, and it's a drive that we should strive to have control over. And that might mean in having control over it that we have lots of sex, or that might mean in having control over it that we don't. It was more a matter of it being something for us to master rather than something for us to just sort of cave into.
I suppose this provides a useful pivot point to what I suppose we'll have to talk about, because it seems to be this one of the major stories of 2017, which is, you know, sexpocalypse and the discovery that basically every male in some kind of position of cultural or political power is pretty much a douche.
Are we really going to call that a discovery? Is that what we're going to call that?
It turns out that you really can't be too cynical, doesn't it? They all do turn out to be. I think the part that I found weirdest in all of this, and this is the parade of people who are now doing the rounds saying, "Well, of course we all knew about Jim or whoever."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if you knew, why didn't you say anything, asshole? You know, oh, we all knew about Kevin Spacey. You know, Gabriel Byrne is being quoted this morning of saying, "Well, you know, oh, Spacey's predilections shut down production on The Usual Suspects for a while." So, you know, these are well-known things. Like, well, if everyone knew about it, why is this just becoming a thing now? Why hasn't someone taken these people down before? Or is that a naive thought?
No, I think the answer is clear, because this was seen as just a little, like, before, this is just a slightly improper quirk, you know? Whereas now, you know, it's a cardinal sin. I think people are just beginning, like, there is, what's happening is there's this new morality that is emerging, and it's being applied for good or ill retroactively on the actions of everyone else. You know, especially in Kevin. That is definitely very interesting. I think in Kevin Spacey's case, the fact that Kevin Spacey was gay and was like performing these acts on men served as a further buffer against him getting in trouble or things coming up.
It's interesting. So, you know, so Spacey and people like that get away with it for a long period of time. And then at the other end of the scale, you have someone like Taylor Swift, who is I didn't know this because I'm not a big Swifty or anything, but apparently, you know, got groped and sued the person and won.
Yep.
And everyone completely dismisses it for reasons that are not entirely clear to me, other than that, you know, she's blonde and successful, and I guess that's a cardinal sin to certain
people. I don't think that's it, actually. I think the concern is that for Taylor Swift, she's not part of the political movement. And so those who would usually be inclined to sympathize with, you know, a famous woman who was groped or harassed by men in power, those people are less sympathetic to people who are not of their tribe, and she's not of their tribe, fundamentally.
Or at least she's perceived as being inadequately enthusiastic in supporting their tribe. But on the other hand, the reaction to Al Franken was kind of split and kind of evolved over time. I mean, that was kind of... They really missed their opportunity there. That was a perfect opportunity to create and enforce a consistent standard that was nonpartisan, and that would cost them nothing, because the governor of Minnesota is not going to appoint, you know, Ron Paul to the Senate, and they missed it. And you know, even though they eventually came around and did the right thing and pushed him out, the time to
what's interesting about that is that the people who really gathered a lot of steam to push him out were his fellow congresswomen, right? I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those were the ones who gathered the steam to push him out. It wasn't because the entire progressive apparatus was on board with it. I mean, I've seen articles on both sides of the question of whether Franken should resign or not from progressive sources. So it was him getting pushed out was really a matter of women who had a little bit of power saying, "Yeah, we're not going to tolerate that."
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that one of the people who's brought this up is or that was a high profile pusher is Gillibrand, who is tipped to be, if not the nominee, then at least a runner in 2020. And so maybe this is, not to accuse a politician of cynicism, but she's kind of may have stuck her finger in the air and seen which way this was going, and decided that this is a good way to kind of co-opt some of that energy. She was the bold truth teller who insisted on applying a bipartisan standard and saying, no, we will not put up with this, even when it's our own guy. And it costs us nothing. So,
yeah, is there a film that we could do? Maybe a very convenient truth.
To play devil's advocate, which in Roy Moore's case is kind of not too far from the truth, but it's a very convenient truth. I think that critics of Moore from way back were not exactly saddened to see him become embroiled in this kind of career end, or what would normally be a career-ending fracas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that, to be fair, that inclines us to believe these allegations, just as the people who are going to vote for him are disinclined to believe these allegations.
Yeah, as a neutral observer, I can only say the allegations seem pretty plausible.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys see that attempt by O'Keefe to discredit the Washington Times and the entire idiocy that was, speaking of Roy Moore?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's outlived his usefulness at this point.
Yeah, I think so too.
Although, ironically, if anything, he discredited, or perhaps I should say he credentialed the Washington Post by proving mm-hmm. that they aren't so desperate to kick Roy Moore that they'll accept just about anything. They turned the story down.
Yeah,
I would love to know how, in the minds of the people who are sure that this is all just the Washington Post out to take down someone with whom they disagree, how they reconcile the fact that clearly they aren't so desperate. I mean, maybe they just say, well, they already got their ammunition. I tend to be with Jonah Goldberg on this. There was an episode of one of his podcasts where he expressed some frustration with the Trump-Moore people who say, well, this is just the Washington Post trying to discredit our guy. And it's like, well, yes, that is actually what they are trying to do, but the means that they are using to discredit them is factual information about what they actually said, and plausible allegations that are actually newsworthy and backed by credible evidence. It's like, well, yeah, I'm sure that the Washington Post would like nothing more than to take down Roy Moore. If only as a means to kick Trump, if not anything personal against Moore. This is, after all, the newspaper that adopted the preposterous slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness."
Which the best line from George Lucas.
Yeah.
Like it's like an episode one. You can
it's episode three. It's so bad.
Yeah. Queen Amidala in the Senate. Democracy dies in darkness, Emperor Palpatine. Yes.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It if someone on Babylon 5 had said that line, when President Clark took over you know, that would be dismissed as just the hackiest of hacky writing.
Yeah.
But, you know, so, yeah, I get that the Washington Post is no friend of Roy Moore, but that doesn't mean that that what they are reporting is incorrect. It just means that they are more willing to serve that story and give that story time and space. But as O'Keefe has now demonstrated, that doesn't mean that they're just going to accept any made-up nonsense.
Mm-hmm. My question out of all of this is, do you guys see, is there a new morality in terms of how sexual relations and relations between men and women should be conducted? Or is this just a passing phase?
It's hard to say whether it will be. I think it's got some more time before it burns out. At a certain point, I thought that the point at which it would burn itself out would be when it touched George Takei. Because here you have someone whose official victim status creds are beyond impeachment, being touched by this. And so surely now everyone will agree that it's gone too far. I don't know when that will actually happen, and it's kind of hard to see what the landscape looks like until we reach that point, because this can keep going, apparently. I don't really understand how. You would think that if someone has been has had allegations to make that they have had in their back pocket for the last 30 years and have never dared to tell anyone because they don't think they're going to be believed, if they haven't brought that up now after all that has happened in the last few months, then really what would it take? You know, it's not like it's not like all of these claims have been filed and they're just sitting in a queue, and you know, there's a bag limit for the week of how many celebrities we can take down, and so you've got to wait your turn. So, you know, okay, yes, I know that Matt Lauer felt you up, but you're just going to have to wait till next week. Right? So it seems like this can't keep running, and yet it seems to keep running on. You know, it'll die down for a while, and then someone will come in with new allegations against, you know, so yet another person. And so until it either burns itself out, or if it reaches a point where it is where everyone would have to agree that this has now clearly gone too far, at that point, then I think we'll have a better sense of what it's going to look like after the smoke clears, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Matt Lauer was a really interesting case. I'm glad you brought him up, Simon. Because what I'm understanding is that Matt Lauer had a button under his desk that allowed him to lock his door remotely.
Now, like, in defense of Matt Lauer, from what I understand, this actually isn't that unusual. The idea behind it is that it's a panic button in case there's someone like some crazy Matt Lauer fan in the halls. He can lock his door, but it does enable him to use it for things like locking assistants in the room with him. That is true.
In terms of architecture, we can suppose that all office buildings designed after this year will for a while have glass doors.
Makes sense. Yeah.
One of the things that people will say in kind of slight defense of, or perhaps opposition to, the witch hunt, as it were, is, you know, we just don't know what the rules are anymore. Well, if you're a 70-year-old journalist, don't take your clothes off in front of a 25-year-old intern. Now, there's one rule for you. You know, all of these incidents are so egregious that I don't think any reasonable person could look at what these guys did and say, I just don't know what the rules are. Is it okay for me to take my junk out in a meeting? Is that okay? No one could know, right? And so that part of it is sloughed off. Another idea that's bitten the dust, there was an article written that suggested that maybe all this has gone too far. I think it was by a woman writing in the New York Post, maybe, but it was written by at least by someone who claimed to be a woman, although in this day and age you can never really know, I suppose, that pointed out that, look, you know, all of this kind of, you know, flirting at work and all this kind of stuff that, you know, that can be pushed too far, you know, this is just what people do. And I thought, well, no, son, it isn't. Actually, this is what extroverts do. And on behalf of introverts everywhere, if we're going to have to make the world just a little worse for extroverts, then, you know, we're all deeply sorry about that. You know, Al Franken's defense was, well, you know, I'm a hugger. And so, you know, on behalf of all the people who aren't huggers who've been accosted by him just innocently hugging them, I'd like to say I hope he gets the chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, you know, a lot of this is not normal workplace problems or people problems or whatever. This is what happens when you let extroverts loose in the wild, and maybe we shouldn't.
I don't think there's a huge connection between extroversion and sexual harassment. My guess is that's probably not the case.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think that if you are an extrovert, you are far more likely to engage in behavior that can be misunderstood, like hugging people. So I'm not making that up. That was one of Franken's defenses, that, well, I'm a hugger.
Mm-hmm. Well, he clearly wasn't hugging that woman in the airplane. You know,
yeah, I think perhaps he has a very different understanding of what it means to hug.
No, he's a jerk. And some of the things that I've heard about him is that he's got a very malicious sense of humor, and he likes to get back at people. And so I think he was miffed or spurned by this woman he was on the USO tour with. And so he decided, ha ha ha, I'm going to humiliate you. And, you know, this happened.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he's not exactly someone you'd make the poster child for the wronged man, would you?
No. You know, I also loved Garrison Keillor's defense, where...
He remembers it differently? Is that
the... No. Garrison Keillor, well, besides he remembers it differently, he also alluded to the fact that women often hug him and reach below his belt.
No, they don't.
Yeah, exactly.
No, they don't.
Yeah, you know.
Often?
Garrison
often seems like a stretch.
Well, like he said, if he had a nickel for every time that... whenever a woman came up to have a picture that she, like, reached below the belt or something like that, then he'd have a lot of nickels.
Sure.
Yeah, because, you know, yeah.
Yeah, he would have lots of nickels, like literally some nickels.
Yeah, yeah.
There would be at least enough to make a quarter.
Yep.
Oh, gosh. I do think that turning to the merits for a moment, what EEOC says constitutes sexual harassment is unwelcome sexual advances, right? I think that my inclination is to say that because it's proper, by and large, to give the putative harassee more or less unilateral authority to say whether it's welcome or not, including quite possibly, you know, changing their minds after the fact, mm-hmm. because how could you possibly know, and, you know, absent, you know, sort of clear and convincing evidence that they had in fact changed their mind. But then the other side of that equation is that I think that you've got to be, if you're going to be a dove on that, you've got to be a hawk on what the predicate conduct is, which is where I think this will eventually go too far. A friend of a friend on Facebook went so far as to say that harassment is defined by the harassee, period. And this is someone who works in human resources, which I found absolutely terrifying. Mm. It's like, no. welcome or not gets to be defined by the heresy, but the predicate conduct, I think, you have to restrict to what reasonable people would recognize is unacceptable conduct, because otherwise you're going to end up with, and I think we will get here, in terms of this may be what it takes to let the fire burn out, is an accusation that gets made against someone where what is being alleged to have happened is not egregious, and you kind of look at it and go, well, okay, but they didn't actually do anything wrong. You just perceived it as being, as being bad. I mean, all of us who work in IT, and this is probably true for many fields, just think of medical, for instance, have been in situations where it's kind of where we have to kind of squeeze past someone, or, you know, there's some kind of physical awkwardness or contact that, you know, believe me, we'd rather not have. And if the person gets to say, I perceived that as predicate conduct and it was unwelcome, then that's not a good place to be in. Mm-hmm. And I think we may get there, and that may be once we get to that point, as I say, I think then we'll have a clearer picture of whether anything lasting is going to come out of this.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get there for another, if I would have my guess, I think it's going to be another 6 months. But in the meantime, I'm willing to let them all burn. Yes. You know, this is a biblical level binding kings and princes of men in chains and fetters of iron. And I am totally delighted to see all of these people and institutions and things burn. One of the things whenever the Harvey Weinstein thing was happening just came out, one of the things I found out was the origin of the casting couch. And I've heard of the casting couch, like, joked about many times, you know, on TV, and people will talk about the casting couch, and I was like, oh, it's just a old Hollywood thing. And come to find out, many Hollywood producers back in the 30s would buy furniture designed to have sex on. So furniture, couches in their office that were easy to have sex on and clean up, for interviewing young starlets on. And this was so common of a practice. Harvey Weinsteinism was so common of a practice that it was known as the casting couch and entered our lexicon. And that's just horrifying.
Yeah, and I'm inclined to agree with you on the burn it all down piece, especially where Hollywood is concerned, because, of course, Hollywood also likes to lecture the rest of America on morality. And it's like, well, who the hell are you to lecture anyone nowadays? Mm-hmm. You know, I've had someone say to me, it's like, well, you just don't understand how, before all this came up, well, you just don't understand how the industry works. It's like, well, now it turns out that we all know exactly how the industry works, and I don't think very much of it. You know, maybe you should rethink how it works.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing.
I think I'm broadly favorable to the standard that says that if people get credibly accused, or even if they just get accused, then they don't get to hold elected office. Mm-hmm. And someone pointed out that the effect of that will be there will be no men in elected office. And I have to say, I think that may be a feature, not a bug. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. I think men have been have held all the power for 4,000 or 5,000 years, and I think we can all agree it hasn't been much of a success.
Have you thought about going on the circuit giving speeches at radical feminist organizations? Like,
I don't think they'd like that.
I don't know. I think like you'd have you'd have like a little, you'd have something there, you know.
I think they'd be very confused.
Exactly. Right? Yes, but, they would.
You know, I have sometimes said that I think that every zealot deserves to be Serena Joyed, making allusion to the character in The Handmaid's Tale who gets exactly the world that she wanted and finds out that it's miserable. Mm. You always worry when you make suggestions about how the world ought to be that you get it and it turns out to be not terribly good. There was a thing I saw on Facebook I think yesterday that said that there should be a reality TV program where these young socialists from college campuses get taken to a country that resembles the one they want, like, say, North Korea or Venezuela, and have to live there for 6 months. I have to say, I don't think it even needs to be a reality show. I think we just need to do that.
We
need to have some kind of charitable endowment for sending, you know, young socialists to go and live in the workers' paradise for 6 months and see how they like it.
I could get behind this initiative. That is for sure.
So speaking of white nonsense, Sam, you this episode of the podcast is brought to you by animated GIFs for days when you just can't even. There's an animated GIF for that. Sam, you had an article in the show notes about white nonsense roundup. Do you want to talk about that?
There's a certain amount of pain associated with the topic for me, but I can. So, there was a wonderful feature article about people who are using social media to be allies in the fight against racism. And the fact that I've never heard of them before suggests that it's, you know, still a small cadre of people who are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty fascinating, the fact that this is an organized thing now. I mean, it's always been a thing, at least by always, I mean, you know, the last several years, that there were certain individuals of a rather pasty skin tone who would go on the internet and sort of browbeat people who didn't agree with their views on racism.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself in a really awkward position about this because I tend to also disagree with those people with regard to their views on racism.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the people doing the browbeating, I just sort of sigh and shake my head at them.
Yeah.
I feel like that being caught in the middle and being kind of, you know, in kind of stuck in no man's land is where all three of us and quite a lot of other people are for the whole of this year so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both parties have gone mad, and we're just in the middle trying to get through it.
We are. We're trying to get through it, and other people are actively engaged in what seems like a sort of religious movement to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are sacrifices to be made for the sake of the cause. There are sins to be confessed.
You have to receive an imprimatur in order to publish.
Yeah, there are orthodoxies you must uphold. It's all very familiar to me as a Catholic.
Interestingly, there are no saints, because although, like we've talked on the podcast before about Woodrow Wilson and FDR and people who sort of, you know, there's a kind of the proto-pantheon in the religion that Sam's describing. They have, or would have on close examination, sins that would be completely unacceptable to the religion today, and yet they never seem to be convicted of that until they are, because as we mentioned, you know, Bill Clinton is now, you know, facing renewed criticism. Now they tell us, right? It turns out that Bill Clinton may actually have not been much of a saint, and so nothing is ever permanent, right? So, you know, the fact that Woodrow Wilson is perfectly fine until the day they decide that he's not is kind of interesting.
Well, that's the communist element of it, right? The revolution is ongoing. And the revolution cannot stop until it is achieved.
And as Joss Whedon has found out, it doesn't matter how much of an ally you were last into the revolution last year, right? Because sooner or later, everyone reaches the point beyond which they can't go, and that is way before where the next generation of revolutionaries starts. I do want to make a couple of meta observations about the the White Nonsense Roundup article, because there were a few things that struck me reading it. The one that I actually kind of liked, I'll come back to a little later, but you know, far be it for me to cast aspersions on CNN, which is currently winning the 2017 media company with the fewest sexual misconduct charges pending against them. but one does wonder whether this article was satire, because the some of the lines in it just seemed ripped entirely from The Onion, and these are worth quoting. I just couldn't believe what I was reading. It was such a breath of fresh air, said Chinua Alamu, a violinist in Springfield, Illinois, randomly enough. Or Tillman, 40, is a leader in the vegan hip-hop movement and often encounters trolls online. I just couldn't believe what I was reading.
The one
that really makes me wonder, and I'm going to completely crib this line from a takedown by a writer called Amanda Prestigiacomo. This is, again, a quote. The anonymity of the volunteers removes any temptation for individuals to seek credit, Kempton said. That is, saith Kempton, quoted in a puff piece in CNN, in which Kempton is identified by name, occupation, and a photograph that CNN broadwaved to its 37 million followers. I also... So they say that White Nonsense Roundup has gained more than 138,000 followers. And, you know, I mentioned the Washington Post earlier being selective in, you know, being perhaps more solicitous and credulous for stories that fit its opinion of Roy Moore. And I do have to wonder if a website with 138,000 users is usually the kind of thing on which CNN would bother to report. I did actually look. There's a website that ranks the top 5,000 YouTube channels. And the very bottom ranked channel, number 5,000, has six times as many subscribers as that. But then I thought, well, that's probably unkind, because obviously YouTube is a very large platform. And Reddit has a similar listing of all the subscriptions on its subreddits. And I'm happy to advise that 138,000 followers would make /r/ White Nonsense Roundup the 73rd largest sub, displacing /r/ Summoner School, which is a League of Legends subreddit dedicated to helping others learn and improve, which only has 137,953. And that's nothing to sneeze at, because it puts it would put /r/ White Nonsense Roundup within striking distance of /r/ Tip of My Penis, 134,000 subscribers. And luminaries such as /r/ Beards with 139,000 subscribers, or even the height of /r/ Asshole Design with 141,341 subscribers. So, you know, these are not numbers to be sneezed at. But, you know, I don't remember the last time I read an article on CNN about /r/ Asshole Design. One thing I did like, and in the article, and I do think is a good idea, it seemed like they were going somewhere other than where they were in the screen cap that they provided of what this group does. And I kind of like the idea of being able to have, like, you probably couldn't do this with software yet, but I like the idea of critical thinking bot, right? So you can implement this in perhaps, like, you know, square brackets, critical thinking bot, close square brackets, at the front of a comment replying, and just challenge the assumptions that are in the statement that's being responded to. And so I don't have it in front of me, but they responded to a statement that I think it was something like, they aren't allowing us to do something anymore. Question, who is they? Right? And things like that. I'm not in the business of defending Pope Francis very often, but there was one that I saw that even I had to get out there and defend, which could have benefited from the same sort of thing, because There was a big splashy story about how Francis wants to change the wording of the Our Father, which, unless you bothered to look up the original story, you would never know from the Fox News, naturally, report, that he was speaking in Italian to Italians on Italian TV. And so, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess he probably meant the Italian translation of the Our Father. And I don't know what the Our Father says in Italian. And, you know, I'd be willing to bet that most of the people, you know, sharing that story probably don't speak Italian either. And so, you know, just a little bit of critical thinking would help. And if that were what this White Nonsense Roundup thing was doing, then I would be all for that.
One of the things that really struck me about the White Nonsense is, like, how they have this White Knight contradiction held in their head, right? Where they want to avoid white knighting and being a white savior to these poor people of colors, and they try to actively avoid that. But at the same time, they open up with, if you are a person of color, you have enough on your plate. It's not your job to educate white people about privilege, racism, and what's going on. And so, like, yeah, we're not going to be white knights, but let's step up in front of you so that way we can handle this because you have enough going on. Like, seems a little contradictory to me.
And presumptuous.
Yes. I'm sure these people are all really well-meaning people.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, these people really do mean well. They genuinely think that they are fighting against racism and fighting for equality and fighting to dismantle institutions that systematically oppress people. I mean, their intentions are really not in question here at all.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain nobility to it. I mean, there's a genuine sacrifice that you make as a person to spend your time fighting the battles that other people are just kind of tired of fighting.
Going out and looking for trolls.
Yeah, I mean, I've dealt with internet trolls a lot, and so I understand what it is they're going up against. And I've also dealt with people who are just genuinely ignorant, well-meaning, but ignorant, and so I understand with those individuals what they're going up against as well. And so I can appreciate that they're making an effort. You know, do I think that their theoretical framework that they're using to approach the issue is useful? Not very. I mean, I think they could benefit from a nice study of the origins of critical theory and its descendants, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
That said, I can genuinely appreciate what they're trying to do, even if they're not particularly effective at doing it. And I think it's incumbent upon those of us who are also against racism to find a better way to do that, to find a better way to talk to those who don't necessarily understand racism very well, and get them to understand that, you know, part of it is unconscious biases. You don't have to actively be a member of the KKK to participate in racist tropes or racist jokes or whatever. I mean, those are things that we can address whether or not we buy into the sort of pseudo-Marxist nonsense that supports their theoretical framework.
Mm-hmm.
Would they be better served to... I don't want to say pick their battles, but I mean be more surgical in what they choose to engage with. And so in the example given in the article, they have a comment to which they're responding that makes a specific point, albeit worded somewhat vaguely. I'm paraphrasing because I don't have it in front of me, but it's something to the effect of, you know, they won't allow, you know, people over 70 to speak anymore. And then goes on to say that they are sick of both parties. And the response points out, you know, first my critical thinking bot thing of, well, who is they? You know, who is this they who aren't allowing people over 70 to speak? And then it goes on to respond to the, well, both parties make me sick, by making pretty stock partisan arguments that don't convince anyone. They don't convince the people advancing them because they already believe that position. And they don't convince the person being argued against because they'll just be dismissed as partisan nonsense. Mm-hmm. I just wonder if it might have been more effective for them to stop after doing the work of critical thinking bot, right? The person who was on the receiving end of that reply is not going to rethink anything and will probably dismiss the one actionable thought that they were given, which is the critical thinking bot piece. So it may be wiser, if this is what they are planning on doing, to challenge the points where there is a definitive right or wrong, a definitive and objective right or wrong answer, and to do it in a way that might actually provoke some kind of thinking on the part of the person that they're talking to, whereas just flooding with partisan talking points doesn't really help anyone.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a bit of that sort of blindness of the throwing out of call-outs and partisan talking points in a way that doesn't actually function in any sort of persuasive way to the people they're dialoguing with. And it's certainly probable that they would be well served to really dig into how those individuals think about racism and ask some questions and learn more about their views on race and establish a relationship with the person, at which point you can actually start the persuasion process. And unfortunately, they seem very disinclined to do that. And that makes sense, because if you're a committed activist and you're dedicated to the cause, you're generally less concerned about getting to know people you think of as deplorables, and you're more concerned with really showing those deplorables, right? Really making sure they know that they're scum. And even if your intentions are good, that sort of attitude, if you genuinely think that they're deplorables, will creep into what you're doing.
Yeah, I suppose it's more healthy that they are at least engaging, even if not very effectively. White Nonsense Roundup does not respond to racist tweets by replying, "You're an idiot," or awarding, you know, the dumbest comments of the year prizes or something like that.
Although perhaps some of those comments could win those prizes.
I mean, my biggest issue with them is they seem to just be like they're parroting out the party line. Mm-hmm. And for better or for worse, unfortunately, both sides, whenever the other side hears the party line, you shut down. You know,
yes.
You just dismiss what's going on. From what I've seen, the most effective way to engage on this front is to actually, as Sam was saying, get to know them as a person. There are, like, I know in different cities they have these meetings and they bring people together from different viewpoints and they just sit and they talk. And that's very effective, but that's time-consuming and you might have to compromise and, you know, it's not, you don't get to shout your bullet points.
I think it's fair. I entirely agree that once someone thinks that they know where you're coming from or thinks that you're using a talking point, they shut down. Because I know that over the last, 13 months or so, I've repeatedly had people say, "Well, why am I going to listen to anything from a Trump supporter?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I always feel like responding to those people is like, you know, okay, well, you got me. Okay, you know, the fact that I've been a vocal Never Trump guy since the beginning, that was all just a ruse, right? You know, what I was trying to do was to get in a position where you, random friend of a friend, would listen to me on this one issue in December of 2017. Well, yeah, done, yeah. You got me. You know, you broke the code, right? You know, so, you know, I think I just wrote the premise for the next Dan Brown novel, actually. That's not bad. but you know, so sometimes Trump does something good. Yeah. You know, a broken watch is right twice a day and all that kind of stuff. Or sometimes he does something for which he is attacked that the attack is unfair. And would embrace a principle that we should not wish to embrace. And if you say something like that, even as someone who is noted to be a non-Trump guy, the very fact that you are not sufficiently opposed to him that you will accept any kind of criticism is taken to be, okay, so you are now in the other tribe, and so I'm not going to listen to anything you say, and I'm going to recast anything you say into talking points for the other side. I can give you an example. We'll talk about the year in Trump in a little bit. But one of the accusations made against, I think it's Michael Flynn, is, well, he violated the Logan Act, which is the very old and almost vanishingly enforced, I think perhaps never enforced, federal statute. Yeah. That forbids private diplomacy, essentially. You know, we could call it, if you enacted it today, you'd call it the Anti-Clinton Foundation statute, I suppose. And it would be unconstitutional as a bill of attainder. But at any rate, Flynn is supposed to have violated this by negotiating or talking to, I think, the Russians, presumably the Russians, in last December. And I think that if the Logan Act can be said to apply to anything, anywhere, at any time, surely the one instance in which it clearly doesn't apply is a member of a transition team for an incoming administration days before that administration is supposed to take office. And it doesn't take an awful lot of imagination to suppose what if in the dwindling days of President Trump's administration, the incoming Gillibrand team calls the president of France and says, "Don't worry. On January 20th at 12:15, these sanctions are going away. Just work with us, bear through it." It doesn't take a lot of nerves to imagine that kind of scenario. And yet, if you point that out, I mean, that if that is a defense of the Trump administration, it's a pretty soft defense, and it's coming from someone who is pretty clearly not a Trump supporter. And yet, that is taken as being, well, you're not, you know, why are you defending Trump? I'm not going to listen to anything from a Trump supporter, which is insane. I don't think that they're going to have much luck talking to people and bringing people along. This is the White Nonsense Roundup people. If they are literally using talking points or anything that sounds like them, and honestly, I think they're going to have much luck if they identify themselves in any kind of partisan way. The not that I should say I've had an awful lot of luck just by trying to encourage people to engage in critical thinking, but that does seem like it would be, if anything can work, that's what will.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's what fails less often.
Yeah, it has the benefit of being honest, and by the way, I don't want to suggest that either side is particularly better or worse than the other on this. Everyone is just in a very partisan moment, and no one is in a mood to hear any kind of suggestion that the other side is not obviously at fault. And it just doesn't seem very healthy. The necessary preconditions for the kind of political society that has been presupposed by the Constitution just no longer exist, it seems to me. It's very difficult to imagine how we go forward when everything has been reduced to raw tribalism. It doesn't matter that Roy Moore is a child abuser because he's not the Democratic candidate. And, you know, you can see this. I posted this on Facebook the other day, and you can see it in the logic. You know, they will say, well, I don't believe the Washington Post allegations.
Yeah.
But more importantly, he's not the Democrat, and if he loses, the Democrat wins. Well, okay, if that's your position, then it doesn't matter whether he's guilty or innocent, right? That's just camouflage. What's really doing the work here is he is of my tribe, not the other tribe. The other tribe is evil, therefore we must forgive all of the sins of our candidate, and we must remember that we are electing a politician, not a priest, and all that really matters is the instrumental goal. It's like, well, so you're perfectly fine electing just about anyone as long as they are on your team. That doesn't strike me as being a recipe for a healthy polity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also amazing that the Democrats have been completely unchastened by the experience of the Trump team taking all this power. You would think that they would be more enthusiastic about taking power away from the White House. But they're doubling down on it, if anything. And so, again, how are political organs supposed to function in that kind of environment? It's quite difficult to see. I hate to beat this drum again, but you know, Sam and I have beat so often, but the answer really is federalism and subsidiarity. Mm-hmm. But that requires, and I'm sorry, Democratic friends, I'm going to pick on you for a minute, but that requires people to be okay with people who live in other states doing things that we don't like.
Yeah.
It requires you to say, you know what, where's that case out of? Is it Missouri, I think? The Masterpiece Cake Shop? It requires people to be willing to say, I think that the baker should not be allowed to deny service to this couple, and I'm going to vote to make that illegal in New York, but I'm just going to let Missouri make the call either way, and if people don't like it, they can move to New York and probably should. And I don't think anyone's going to be willing to do that. Everyone now wants every issue settled nationally. Their way, and that isn't going to work. We're not going to be able to survive as a country if every issue becomes a federal issue, when we are so profoundly divided on so many things. I really do wonder which if you gave them a clean choice, which would the Democrats prefer? Do you want to lose Roe v. Wade? You know, my way and Justice Scalia's way, which is that the states get to decide. Or do you want to lose it, as in there's a right to life in the Constitution and abortion is therefore against the Constitution, which is an argument that is not a very serious argument, but is nevertheless pressed somewhat fervently by some pro-lifers. You know, yeah, they would settle it the other way nationally. And I don't think that would be very healthy either.
whoa, Simon, take a step back. What you need to do is just trust that the federal government knows what it's doing. Just believe.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm obviously kidding here, but you know, that is pretty much the view of some people. It's incredibly, I guess it's an instinctively authoritarian kind of thing, where you just kind of assume that the father knows best state is, you know, it's legitimate, and that's fine, and we should all do the same thing, and rah, 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 go Team America, but only the Team America that I like.
Yeah. Well, I understood that view, at least in relatively young people, prior to last November, when Trump was elected, because if you came of age politically at the dawn of the age of Obama, as it were, and like all of the rest of us, you assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president, only you really wanted it to be Bernie, and maybe you voted for him. But there was never any serious question that that Trump guy was going to get it, right? Then, you know, it made a certain amount of sense at that point to say, okay, we support an omnicompetent federal government because it's always going to be in our hands. But one might have thought that the fairly brutal demonstration that, no, actually, sometimes you just lose, and someone you really don't like gets to now wield these weapons you have created, you know, you'd think that there would be a reaction to that, that people would maybe learn some kind of lesson and say, well, you know, I don't like Betsy DeVos. I don't think Betsy DeVos should be in charge of school policy, and I realize that we created this department and made it larger and more powerful, and maybe that was a mistake and we ought to retrench it. But no one is saying that.
Yeah. Well, you know what their argument is actually going to be? We need to make it so next time he can't win.
Oh, yeah. They're already talking. There's already... I've seen memes floating around about how terrible the Senate is again. and, you know, you can bet that the Electoral College isn't far behind.
Yeah, you know... They just need to wait to the Death Star is fully operational, and then they can abolish the Senate, and the governors will rule directly.
And democracy will die in darkness.
Yes, democracy will die in darkness.
But see, and I don't want to turn this into a whole Electoral College thing, but you know, it really is a dim-witted point of view, because, and again, this is something that Trump said, but it's nevertheless true. If the rules of the game are different, everybody knows it and changes their behavior accordingly. And so to say that, well, Trump only won because of the Electoral College, and so we need to change that to make sure that they can't win again next time, ignores the reality that if you are a Republican in the Central Valley in California and Election Day rolls around and you have literally anything else on your task list, that is a better use of your time than voting for the Republican candidate for president in a state that is going to vote for the Democratic president, come hell or high water. Okay, before we get to the year in Trump, we should pause and talk about our sponsor. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by ShredTex. If you or a member of your staff are under imminent federal indictment, you need to know where your shredder is, and you need it to mean business. The ShredTex 5000 reduces all that pesky evidence to confetti that even the most diligent FBI director turned prosecutor won't be able to put back together. And best of all, ShredTex is offering special seasonal discounts at www.imnotguiltyimjustcareful.com/Trump. So, what's been going on in the world of politics?
No investigation by anybody reputable. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope, definitely not.
No.
Clearly, if an FBI agent has an opinion about something, that means that the whole game is off. Right?
Yes.
That's how people work.
Yeah.
Do we think that... How high is this going to get? Right, is this going to... I mean, I don't think in this case we can ask, what did the president know and when did he know it? Because the answer is obviously nothing and never. literally nothing, literally ever. But, I mean, is it going to reach Jared Kushner? Is he going? And just how willing is Donald Trump to throw out immediate, if legal, family to save his own skin?
I think it depends on, I think how high this goes depends on the midterm elections. I am partial to Andrew McCarthy's take on this on National Review, where he argues that this is in fact an impeachment investigation to basically involve Trump in a cover-up of the cover-up type thing in order to eventually impeach him. I think that... So my reading of Trump in terms of close family is that he's very much a, of the mafioso point of view. And so, blood runs thicker than political ties. And so if I think if the prosecutor goes after immediate family, we'll see a dismissal of the prosecutor and then further cost towards impeachment.
Yeah, I think if the Dems take the House, they, which, you know, 50-50, but I think that they will definitely proceed with impeachment, which will pretty equally definitely fail in the Senate, because they have no incentive not to. Mind you, I also said that Trump, a year ago, that Trump had no incentive not to prosecute Hillary Clinton, and they haven't started, although he, it would seem, has not forgotten about that, because he periodically throws that out as kind of red meat to his base.
Mm-hmm.
I think it should be concerning to people who don't like Trump very well but have some level of intellectual integrity that so far the investigation has not really turned up anything except problems relating to the investigation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that classic kind of you know, they get appointed to investigate Whitewater or whatever, you know, or the Scooter Libby thing, and the only thing that ultimately comes out of it, lies told to investigators in the course of the investigation, and the original purpose of it dies in darkness. And that seems concerning. I mean, you would think that that if there were any if this investigation ultimately finds no underlying problem, I'm not saying there should be like a no harm, no foul rule, but in a certain sense, Trump supporters could then feel quite vindicated that this whole thing was a witch hunt and a deep state coup. You know, and that seems not exactly a good idea.
That's a concern I have as well, that this is going to be, at least it's going to be perceived as a sort of attempt to get Trump that ultimately fails because Trump is, for all of his bungling, a fairly harmless bungler. And he ends up coming out of it on the other side, the aggrieved victim of circumstance, and not the horribly incompetent authoritarian that he is.
I think the mafioso line that Mike had was a pretty good description of what I read is, you know, his mindset, behavioral tics, whatever you want to think of it as.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that kind of reflexive authoritarian thing. But yeah, it may come to the same thing, because either way, right? So if the investigation does find some underlying misconduct, it's going to be dismissed by Trump's supporters. And if it doesn't, and it just produces indictments and so on that came up during the course of the investigation, it's going to be dismissed by Trump's supporters. They're never going to accept it either way. But the difference will be whether they're right or not. And it seems to me that when they're right, we should probably not dismiss that. What are we going to say? The mere fact that they have poor judgment means that they are not capable of being right, and so we would prefer to be wrong than to align ourselves with them. That would be insane.
Also normally human.
Yes.
I hope not. I mean, you know, I would hope that so, like, you know, the stock line is, well, you say what you like about Trump, but, you know, look at all these judges that he's filling. And, of course, the left is doing its usual thing of freaking out and not making any kind of distinctions between nominees with whom we don't agree and nominees who are egregious.
Right.
There was one, I think, that was like a 35-year-old blogger. Now, I'm not saying that I wouldn't accept a nomination to the federal bench, but I just think that I should probably not be the leading member of the farm team, if that's what it comes to. One might hope that the Federalist Society has, you know, somewhat more qualified people than me to appoint. But you know, to the extent that that is true, that he is basically put the Federalist Society in charge of judicial nominations, and that's really all the Senate has been doing all year, then mm-hmm. certainly conservatives should probably, and libertarians, and you know, generally speaking, Federalist Society types, should probably applaud that. You know, I wouldn't say but Gorsuch, I would say but Amy Coney Barrett, who was confirmed to the Seventh Circuit and is now being talked as you know Papa Bile or whatever we're going to call SCOTUS Abile, and you know that would be great, that would be fantastic if he appoints Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. That's fantastic, and should probably be praised for that. But they don't seem capable of making that kind of distinction on the other side. I see that this comes up all the time in the context of, well, you know, if you impeach Trump, then you're still stuck with Mike Pence.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that if your position is, I mean, you can't have it both ways, right? Either Donald Trump is a uniquely extraordinary threat to democracy, a black swan event, completely different, yada, 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 or he's just a stock Republican, and so any stock Republican is just as bad. I mean, you can't have that both ways, because whatever Mike Pence is, he's not some kind of crazy, extraordinary lunatic. Mm-hmm. You know, he is a Republican from central casting. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so they don't seem to be able to decide for themselves, which, you know, what is our beef with Trump? Mm-hmm. Is it that he is a kook, or is it that he's a Republican? And the same thing with the judges. You know, is the beef that they are, that he's appointing people in the mold of Justice Thomas? Well, then, if that's your beef, then I'm sorry to break this to you, but you lost the election. That was pretty much going to happen regardless of which Republican won. I mean, unless you think Susan Collins was going to get the nomination.
Well, I mean, for a lot of liberals, you know, there is no difference between a kook and a Republican. That's the common assault against Republicans and conservatism more generally. Every couple of years, you'll see an article in Psychology Today explaining how being a conservative is actually some form of mental illness. And I think Trump for them is a perfect excuse to see this in practice for them. And unfortunately, the Republican Party isn't doing them any favors in regards to this.
Wait, it's not doing them as in Democrats, or it's not doing themselves any favors?
Well, yeah, themselves. it's doing a whole bunch of favors to the Democrats. That is definitely true.
I don't know that I would have counted on the Republican Party being as basically incompetent at politics as it has seems to have proven to be this year. I mean, it's genuinely astonishing that with a Republican House and a Republican Senate and a nominally Republican president, they have gotten literally nothing done except confirming a handful of judges. I'm sure they've named some post offices, but that's almost literally it.
It shows you how much Congress has atrophied. Over the past 40 years, 50 years, maybe even longer, you know, I think I would go all the way back to Wilson and FDR as starting this, but both Republicans and Democrats have taken advantage of the fact that congressmen want to be reelected and found this unique way of being reelected by not doing anything. And so the congressional muscle is nothing. And in the absence of presidential leadership, Congress isn't interested in going out on a limb and voting for stuff. And I think this also shows us that the political system as we know it is dying, and something else is going to rise in its place. And I don't know what.
You've said on a previous episode that in some ways we're becoming a more normal country, and several podcasts that I've listened to have talked along a similar theme lately about how Trumpism is kind of a normal right-wing party anywhere else in the world, seems to think of the how things are everywhere else in the world is how they ought to be here. In that sense, becoming a more normal country may require more normal political institutions. Although I don't think that legislatures anywhere else are notably more competent than is the American Congress. I mean, the Italian Parliament is not exactly regarded as kind of, you know, the world's greatest deliberative body. It may be that we have a wonderful constitution for a country that doesn't exist anymore.
I think that's where we're headed.
Hard to see how that would shake out, but one could imagine, are there enough blue states to call a constitutional convention? Because I think that that's the only way that this happens. Right.
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're already there. We already, practically speaking, do not have co-equal branches of governments, right? You know, the Congress waits for the president to set the initiative. Congress waits for the president to present them with a budget that they fiddle with. You know, the Constitution is just words on a page, and we can interpret those as we see fit, unfortunately, because, you know, the words themselves don't have inherent power to enforce what they actually mean.
Would that I'm wondering to what extent, my feeling is a little different on the current cause of, you know, congressional woes, and so my feeling on that kind of paralysis is a little different. It seems to me that part of the problem is that Congress is so, or particularly the Senate, is so closely divided that any one person can be the marginal vote, and so has inordinate power to demand concessions, that they are literally the only person in the Senate who wants that, but that's the price of doing business, and so you get the Cornhusker kickback, and you get weird provisions that make no sense to appease Susan Collins, and you get weird provisions that make no sense to appease Rand Paul, and then in the House you have something similar, but with groups rather than individuals, and so you have the Freedom Caucus. With whom I'm generally sympathetic, but they wield enough votes that they can basically demand anything gets put into the bill. In that sense, they are aligned against the House Republican leadership just as much as they are against the Democrats. And so when you have these kinds of closely aligned situations, it's no wonder that it's difficult to push through bills, because it's very difficult to satisfy both the Freedom Caucus and Susan Collins. And so I wonder if you get a Democratic wave next year and they take back the House and the Senate by crushing margins, which seems unlikely, but, you know, for sake of argument, I think you might see an awful lot of movement, because at that point, you know, Donald Trump does not care about what wins he gets. He just cares about winning. He has no substantive political commitments of any kind. This is another thing. The Democrats have this problem that they don't actually understand the man. They've proven as incapable of changing their critique of the Republican president as this particular president has proven of incapable of changing in office. Right? They continually act as though Ted Cruz were the president. And he isn't. If the Democrats were in Congress, Trump would change his behavior and would work with them to take the wins that he could get. And unless they are complete idiots, which is always possible, the Democratic leadership would ram through their wish list and get his signature on it while they have the chance. To the extent they wouldn't, it would simply be because they are too so beholden to their base that they would feel more compelled to do the impeachment thing than to work with him. But that may just be because they're as dim-witted as he is.
That's my thing, is that I think that there'll be enough Democrats, like the leadership will be anxious to work with them, as we've seen already, that Chuck Schumer has attempted to pull deals with Donald Trump. And two things will happen. One, Donald Trump is notorious for, like, you know, changing his mind at the last minute or in between 1 second and a knot and another. And so I could imagine him pulling out of deals and changing deals and frustrating the Democrats to the point that they're not interested in working with him. It's just too much difficulty. And secondly, I think you'd have a significant amount of revolt from the progressive faction because they feel that, you know, working with Donald Trump, any sort of collaboration is treason. And so I think you will have a slight movement to kill any sort of bipartisan deal because it's been sullied with the hands of Trump.
What would happen if they passed socialized medicine through our theoretical or hypothetical Democratic House and Senate, and Trump signs it and starts wandering around calling it Trump care?
Well, that's the thing, is that it won't. It's a little too far to actually be serious about this, but I could almost see a significant faction demanding that they enacted bills in order to make sure that Trump vetoed them and they can override the veto. Like, you know, they might name their socialized medicine the Trump Small Hands Bill or something in order to make sure that he vetoes it.
It would be something akin to if we had an order from the Vatican tomorrow that Pope Francis has declared that the Novus Ordo is to be suppressed and the Latin Mass is henceforth the only Mass in the Church. I don't think that people like me would know quite what to do with that. Like, yeah. Okay, well, it's certainly the right idea. We're little surprising, but, you know.
Yeah.
You know, be careful who your friends are.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
But, I mean, you know, I can certainly see, I would certainly agree that there's going to be a progressive faction that doesn't want anything to do with him, but at the same time, I have to assume that Chuck and Nancy are not as stupid as they play on TV. You know, they've both been around long enough to be, you know, canny politicians. And one would hope that they, I suppose I don't hope. What I hope is that they'll mess it up, but, time will tell, I suppose. Do either of you, at this point think that there's, that the odds on Trump getting re-elected have changed significantly? I rather feel that the needle hasn't moved an awful lot.
Yeah, I have to say, I have not noticed the needle moving a lot. I mean, I've watched progressive opinion change on the subject, and I've watched that needle move, but my personal needle on whether he's going to be impeached or not hasn't moved a lot.
What we've seen over the last year has mostly been an exercise in people who already didn't like him getting angrier about him, and people who were behind him before getting more or less, you know, if moving at all, then moving more into his column. And one of those coalitions prevailed last time and the other did not. I don't quite understand how you start from a losing coalition, subtract members, and then win. It doesn't seem really calculated to produce victory.
Well, it's calculated to produce a moral victory where you get to feel really great about how right you were.
The one thing is, like, you know, from what I can see in the polls is that, you know, Trump's doing horrible in the polls. He's under, what, 45%? I don't know how you achieve re-election with that number.
But these are the same polls that, on the night before the election, predicted certain defeat.
Yeah, that is true.
I wonder whether they have corrected whatever defect it was that led them to understate Trump's support, a year ago. Because if they haven't, or if we don't have any reason to think that they do, then that doesn't really give a lot of confidence that they can call it right now. I suppose that on some level the worst case scenario would be an even bigger popular vote loss, but with the same result. That will fuel the demands that we have to get rid of the Electoral College now, because now it's twice in a row and it's becoming more acute. And we have this, this egregious person who's been re-elected to another term. Or maybe they'll just retake the House and impeach him. I mean, it's entirely possible that both scenarios play out. The House impeaches him. The Senate says no. He gets re-elected. Mm-hmm. And so what does the House do? Re-impeach him? I mean, that seems a little weak. We're going to keep re-impeaching the president in the same way that the Republicans did Obamacare repeal bills. You got to impeach him like five or six times, and each time the Senate says, nope, not doing that.
Yeah, I could see something like that. And, I can't wait for the the feverish New York Times editorials demanding that Trump just go ahead and resign to save the country the humiliation of yet another impeachment.
This time we'll get him.
Yes.
I'd have gotten away with it if it weren't for you pesky senators. none of this exactly is encouraging, although there is surely some historical irony if it falls to Donald Trump, of all people, to replace Justice Ginsburg and Justice Kennedy. It's one thing to talk about silver linings when you're just, you're maintaining the status quo. But when you get to a point where you're significantly changing the game, that's just a horrible scenario to imagine, but it's not probably that far off that, the Democrats win the House next year, they impeach the president, the Senate refuses to convict, the president is re-elected, and then Justice Ginsburg dies. The House would, of course, immediately re-impeach him, and the Senate would again shrug, presumably. Then the question is, well, now he's going to nominate this thing. Now you have this real kind of fight between the House and the Senate.
Well, that sounds like fun.
I see. It sounds like it's a good premise for a potboiler political thriller.
What would it take for the Senate to actually convict?
I think it's a two-thirds vote, isn't it?
I mean politically. In terms of...
I don't know that there is any... I think that they're in too deep, the Republican members. I think it would be very hard to imagine anything short of the not proverbial Trump shooting someone in the street on camera that he referenced during the campaign, because I think he's probably correct that his supporters wouldn't even abandon him then, depending on who it was.
Like, what if What if that dirt dossier was true? What if the dirt dossier was true?
Then his supporters would just say, well, what's wrong with getting peed on? Everyone loves getting peed on by Russian hookers.
Yeah, that is true. Him and
this
Roy
is also
Moore.
Coincidentally what it would take to turn Hollywood and the Democrats more generally into prudes.
because they
would immediately say it's terrible. How could anyone be peed on by Russian hookers? And you'd have Trump supporters saying everyone loves getting peed on by Russian hookers. Who doesn't like that?
Yeah, the RNC will ask Penthouse Forums to direct a biography of Trump's life. Then
you assume that's not already in the works.
No, I'm sure it is. Stone and Penthouse Forums presents Trump: A Golden Story.
You'll start seeing demand for sex bots that are capable of urination. Clearly, to a dark place this conversation will carry us.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. No, I really have a hard time imagining anything that could be a sufficient bombshell to shift the particularly the Senate Republicans, because they have to have seen that election in Virginia and be scared witless, because now it's clear that if they walk away from Trump, they're screwed. If they embrace Trump, they're screwed. And if they try and walk a fine line between embracing him and walking away, they're probably screwed too. And so, you know, the path of least resistance is to double down on what's worked so far. Say, well, you know what? The Democrats don't really like me, but they're not voting for me anyway.
Yeah,
and independents, you know, mostly Democrats anyway. Just, you know, Democrats in all but name, which may or may not be true. I think that's less true now than it was, you know, a year and a half ago. But I think they can make that the call based on that. And so all of the available information to them says the only way out of this mess is to say party Uber Alice. And stick with Trump, and hope that they don't get primaried. Yeah, I mean it's I mean unless they're all going to retire, you know. Is it conceivable that that enough of them would want to retire to combine with the Democrats? I mean, it's like if it came up right now, Bob Corker and Jeff Flake may very well vote to convict. Susan Collins certainly would. And so maybe you can get enough of those to get to whatever it is, I think it's 2/3 or 3/4. I forget what the margin necessary is.
Yeah.
We all better look that up before next November. So, you know, it's possible that you get a few here and there. But on block, it's quite difficult for me to imagine what it would take.
What do you guys think about Trump's Jerusalem statement?
Sure, I experienced a great deal of boredom around that event.
Yes. Like, what was interesting to me is something that, like, wasn't even reported on, but was, like, with all of this hullabaloo with him announcing that Jerusalem is Israel's capital and he's instructed the State Department to blah, 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 was the fact that he did still sign the extension. So it's all hot air. Yeah. So he signed the extension, even though while at the same time declaring this.
Did he say that this is the last time he's signing it, and he's just signing it for a 6-month transition period or something?
From what I understand, no. Like, I did not hear that.
That under a normal administration, I would say that that would be a reasonable position to take. You know, you announce that this is the last time I'm signing this extension. Same with the Iran nuclear deal, right? If you're going to recertify the nuclear deal, you could say, okay, we're done with this. This isn't working out. But in order to give adequate notice, I'm going to, you know, preserve the status quo for another 6 months, but that's it. This is not going to be signed again, so that everyone can kind of get their pieces in order. I think this is one of the things that he's where he's done something smart and deserves some credit for it. Not that I think that he probably understands what he's done or why, but I would entirely associate myself with Jonah Goldberg's column on it in National Review the other day, that points out that this whole thing is just a shell game. That there is no peace process. There hasn't been a peace process for a very long time. And there's a kind of Charlie Brown in the football feel to all this of, well, you know, if you just give us another 6 months before you know, without recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, maybe we'll be able to make some process in this non-existent peace process. And it just never happens. And it never happens because they're not interested in a two-state solution. They're interested in a one-state solution.
Yeah. So, like, my thought is that, yeah, Jay Nortlinger said, and I agree, that there is never a good time for this. And so my initial thought was kind of, yeah, this is the right move to do, but at the same time, you know, it's such a... It doesn't mean anything. Practically, it's just such a symbolic move, and it's going to cost us internationally. That being said, we're burning through so much goodwill, we might as well just do this as well. And I think it does have the advantage of a bit of an Overton window effect, where... this occurs, and provided that the embassy does actually move, which hasn't happened yet, and possibly might not actually happen. So provided that the embassy does actually move, it'll be difficult for another administration to reverse this. And with the United States having the position that Jerusalem is Israel's capital, then eventually other countries are just going to fall in line with the American position.
Although I suppose that the new American embassy in Jerusalem, you know, you better build it big and strong, because that will be the number one terrorist target in the world. It would be it'll be the black box in Mecca that they process around. It'll be something like that for terrorists. You know, they'll all process around it, throwing grenades at it.
This embassy is going to be huge. It's going to be top notch. It's going to be so big, and he's got a great deal where between him and Mar-a-Lago. It's going to be Mar-a-Lago, Israel. It's going to be great.
Well, you can see the kind of, you know, the Trump logo on it. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, that is, you know, you're just inviting someone to, you know, throw a truck bomb at it. And so what does the day after that happens look like? When PLO-associated terrorists have now attempted to blow up the American embassy in Israel. And I assume that Abbas is smart enough, or at least canny enough, that he would immediately condemn that and say this is a stupid thing, and sincerely condemn it, because it's a stupid thing that would end up causing if anything could make America get off the fence and come in on the side of Israel in a way that hasn't become hasn't done before, that would be it. But it only takes one idiot, right? You know, a truck bomb is not necessarily a particularly sophisticated thing, as we have seen. So unless you're going to have, even if you're going to have 20-foot thick walls after the fashion of a medieval castle, you know, you're going to have eventually an image on your television screen that looks something like Oklahoma City, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, like, you know, if you can't get to the embassy itself, they'll shoot up the queue waiting outside the embassy to get in. Or, you know, you just, all of these checkpoints just move the line of attack further and further out.
It's okay, Mike. We're just going to have them ban guns within a couple of miles of the embassy. That'll do it, right?
Yes. Though I'm sure that the Israelis are going to be very motivated to do whatever they can to prevent attacks at the American embassy. they're very good at that. So
I'm not sure that they've got to look like they are doing everything humanly possible to prevent that, while actually doing as little as possible, because from their perspective, that's the best thing that could possibly happen, right?
That's an interesting idea. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a little Machiavellian, but I mean, that's it would redound to their benefit politically, one should imagine, for America to get punched on the nose by their enemies. Right, you know, no one was happier about Pearl Harbor than the Chinese government.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
Ooh, conspiracy theory, you know. It was reported in the Washington Post, and the Washington Post hates President Roosevelt. So I just don't believe it. Clearly, it was the Chinese that did it. Can anyone prove it was the Japanese? You know. Let's talk about PS7. Anyway, that joke fell flat. PS7, Building 7. Okay.
Oh, sorry. That was a bridge too far.
A bridge on the River Kwai too far, perhaps?
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah. I think that we're probably winding down, but Sam, there was an article that you had on the show notes about... I think it was a Hollywood company or tech companies, I think, out west that was hiring models to come to their Christmas party. Is there something you wanted to talk about in regard to that?
Yeah, that's a sort of interesting phenomenon. I don't think it's completely new, but I thought there was something interesting to talk about there with regard to people who are probably considered, you know, nerdy social outcasts in high school who now have money and can purchase attractive, popular friends. The kind of people who went to the high schools they would have gone to but would never have dared to socialize with these people who now have tons of money. And I found myself wondering which part of this was the more tragic part of it. You know, is the more tragic part of it the fact that these, you know, former nerdy outcasts who now have money have sort of decided to fulfill their high school fantasies by having the popular kids hired to show up at their parties? Or is the tragedy that the popular kids are not in a position to turn down the offer to show up at the nerdy kids' parties these days? And I can't quite decide which it is.
I actually sympathize a little bit with what's going on here. You know, engineers are really awkward. And at the same time, you need to keep the engineers happy. And so adding attractive people who can pretend to laugh as a social lubricant makes a lot of sense. I understand what's going on here. At the same time, since this article dropped, I wonder how many of these parties, like, that's going on in this Christmas season, you have all of the engineers trying to figure out who's actually supposed to be there and who's not, and, like, formulating algorithms to try and match up points of connection between the people they don't recognize.
Part of that, yeah, that last part is the part that is striking to me, that they don't recognize people. I mean, I you know, even as someone who is not notably extroverted, I find it strange that that people know their colleagues so little that they don't recognize a bunch of models who they've never seen before in their lives at the company Christmas party. You would think that they would probably know.
Well, they explain in the article that what they're claiming to do is the models are supposed to say, "Oh, I'm a friend of Tony, and Tony invited me to the party. Oh no, I don't work here at Games, but I know Tony."
It's yeah. Isn't it amazing go ahead.
I was going to say, no, it wouldn't normally pass the sniff test, but under normal circumstances, these people aren't going to be sniffing too hard.
I was really trying not to make a joke about that.
Yep.
Another interesting development in this is that a friend of mine recently linked me an article about the popularity of hiring companions in Japan. And and apparently it's gotten a bit more serious. It's not just like hiring someone for a party. Like you can legit hire someone to be your kid's friend for years. I mean it's pretty wild. And
like what age? Like, are you hiring other kids to be kids' friends?
Yes, sir.
Wow.
Yeah,
I guess the British did that.
No, we just invaded other countries and required them to show up to our parties.
Yeah, but you would have the little native girl be friends to your occupying governor's kids.
That seems less like modeling than slavery and cultural genocide, but, you know, come see, come see.
Well, you know, you guys, you know, do what you're good at.
To some people it is, you know, given to be priests. To others it is given to be prophets. To others it is given to occupy the Punjab.
Exactly. You know, someone has to end the practice of throwing women on fires and at the same time favor a racial group because they're taller than the other racial group and end up causing genocide, like, you know, 50 years later.
See, President Putin is going to run for another term.
Oh, wow, that's a surprise. Jeez. Do you think he's going to win? Oh, jeez.
I don't know, but I hear Hillary Clinton seeking Russian citizenship, so, you know, you never know.
What we need to do send Bernie Sanders over there to run against him. or at least Larry David.
No, enough about your damn emails.